All right, welcome to this live interactive webcast where my name is Tony Melvin. I'm the Managing Director of Chan & Naylor, and we'll be interviewing today Michael Yardney of Metropole Properties, who's the leading property commentator and director of Metropole, and has also written two fantastic books, which is How to Grow a Multi-Million Property Portfolio in Your Spare Time, which is a great read, and also his latest one, which is All You Need to Know About Buying Property, Buying and Selling Your Own Home, I should say. Also, we'll be talking to Ed Chan, who's the co-founder and director of Chan & Naylor, and he's probably one of the leading accounting experts in the country, and also the co-author of several books, actually, three, one about how to legally reduce your tax, how to control your super now, and his latest one, which is How to Achieve Wealth for Life, all about property investing. So I have the two gentlemen with me today. How are you guys? Are you on there?
Good evening. Yep. Thank you. Good day. Welcome.
It's Ed here.
Hi, Ed. Thank you. And Michael?
Good evening, everybody. Yep. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Excellent.
Ed
here. Hello, everyone.
Well, the technology shows me we've got over 500 people on the line listening live, Tony, so that's exciting, and we're going to obviously have lots of people listening to the replay too.
Excellent. Yeah, this is actually getting recorded, so if you miss anything as we go through the next hour, you can actually download it and listen to it again. So the purpose of this little webcast is to educate our listeners. We get a lot of questions from the seminars and things that we do, and this interactive webcast, many of you have sent in questions, and we're going to be going through and asking Ed and Michael to answer those for us in the next hour. Also, we want to encourage you to learn more by coming to our upcoming seminars that we're doing right around Australia, where you can meet and listen to Michael and Ed live in Sydney, Perth, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Canberra. And there is a link on the website there as you're listening. You can book into that if you haven't already. Little quick disclaimer. This is, of course, just a general advice. If you want to pursue any of the information during this webcast, you do need to obviously go and meet with the appropriate professional, whether it's finance, financial planner, accountant, and so on. So we're going to kick off with the first question. I'm going to shoot that to you, Ed. And we get this actually quite a lot. And people here are asking about what is happening with hybrid trusts and negative gearing. This is from Andrew Reed in Victoria. And I would like to know the answer myself, Ed. So over to you.
Okay, I think what Andrew's referring to is probably the two private rulings recently that got knocked back by the tax department. And the first private ruling was 65710, and that basically disallowed the deduction for interest on money that was borrowed to buy units in a hybrid trust. And when you look into the case and you drill down into the detail, what actually happened was that the accountant or whoever it was that applied for the private ruling, actually the trust deed itself was not a hybrid trust. It was actually a discretionary trust. So it wasn't able to distribute units as such. So it failed not on the basis that the hybrid trust wasn't working, but it failed on the basis that, that it wasn't the right trust deed. So the lesson there is that you've just got to make sure that you know you're getting the right deed, the right trust deed, for the right purpose. The second private ruling
interrupt you there. It was called a hybrid trust, wasn't it? But it was actually was not a hybrid trust. Yeah.
Correct. It was called a hybrid trust, but then when the tax department sort of looked into the detail of the deed, it was actually a discretionary trust. It had wordings that it could issue some units, but the units were not fixed as such, and and therefore, bottom line was it wasn't the right deed, and that's what stopped it from going ahead.
Okay, yeah, fine. And the other one.
The second private ruling was 66298, where, again, whoever it was, the accountant that applied for the private ruling, applied on the basis that they were buying income units in a hybrid trust, and the taxpayer should be able to claim the interest as a tax deduction. Not much, very similar to buying a property and negative gearing the property in your own name. And that was knocked back, and it was found that the tax department only allowed the interest to be deductible to the extent of the rent itself. So it wouldn't allow anything that was over and above the rent that was received. And once again, when you look into the detail of it, it wasn't so much the hybrid trust was a problem. It was more that when they were asked a question, when the accountant and the taxpayer was asked a question that when will this negative gearing become positive, their answer was never. And of course, you know, what else can the tax department do is to limit the deduction to the rent because there's no commerciality. See, when you would think about it, when you buy a property, the reason why, if you bought the property in your own name, the reason why the tax department allows you the negative gearing and claim the interest as a tax deduction or the negative gearing as a tax deduction, you know, they're obviously losing money. The tax department is giving you a refund on all that. The reason why they allow that to happen is because eventually that property is going to become positively geared. And if you're eventually going to sell the property, you're going to pay capital gains tax. So eventually the taxman is going to get his money. So somewhere along the line he's going to get his money. Now, in this case here, the accountant basically said, no, you're not going to ever get your money because it will never become positively geared. So there was no commerciality. So the taxman had no option but to knock it back. Now, if you didn't understand the detail of it, then, you know, there's people going around saying, oh, this hybrid trusts are no good and so forth. But really, if you knew what you were doing and the accountant knew what he was doing, then he wouldn't have answered the question with a no, never become positively geared. So, again, no one in their right mind.
Correct. Sorry, no one in their right mind would actually invest to purposely lose money forever either, would they?
Exactly. So I guess the lesson from all that is, firstly, you know, if you're gonna win a horse race, you've got to buy the right horse to begin with. That means the right trust deed, and then secondly, you've got to get the right jockey to ride that horse to win the race. So you need both. The jockey being, you know, the accountant doing the tax returns properly to get the right result. So, there was a lesson in that, but it doesn't mean that hybrid trusts are no good. If you go to the tax department's website and they actually refer to IT, there's a tax ruling on this, it's 2684, and it's in the tax department's website, and they'll show you how to use a hybrid trust properly. So it's not that you can't do it, but it's just that you've got to do it properly, that's all.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for that, Ed. So hopefully Andrew has got his answer there. So the next question I'll give to Michael, and I'll read this out. This is from Gary Kazar, I believe that's pronounced right, in Victoria. And he says, Michael, there is a large amount of talk in the press about housing affordability at the moment. With any future growth in housing prices, affordability will become even worse. Do you expect affordability to impact on the next price growth wave?
Thank you for your question, Gary, and I can understand where you're coming from because a lot of people are wondering the same thing, especially with all that's happening in the press. But can I tell you, Gary, I don't think affordability is an issue for the majority of homeowners. 70% of Australians, 65% of Australians own their home. A large percentage of them actually own it outright, and a lot of Australians are paying it off. And anyone who's bought a house 10 years ago in any capital city in Australia are sitting on an asset that's worth 7 or 8 times what they paid for it. Housing affordability is only an issue for first homeowners, but if it was an issue for the majority of people in the property market, prices wouldn't keep going up. But the latest reports have shown that every state has had growth in the last quarter and in fact over the last year, which really means that affordability is not a real issue for the majority of Australians. It's only a particular sector. So therefore, some properties are going to keep going up in value and others won't. The beginning of the property cycle always starts with the more affluent properties doing well, because in the more affluent suburbs, people can afford it and aren't worried. It's just, I guess, the outer rim and the new homeowner that's having trouble, Gary.
Excellent. Thanks for that. And I'll give the next one to you again, Michael. We've got here Durek Kapoor from New South Wales, and he says, where do you think Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney and Adelaide in the property cycle at present?
Thank you for the question. We're going to be discussing that in great detail in the seminars that Ed and I are starting this weekend and going to go around 5 states in Australia. So we're going to go into a lot of detail of where each state is in the cycle. But if I can briefly say it here so we can move on to other questions, the property market is, I guess, in 3 sectors. Perth and Darwin are at their peak of their booms now. Darwin's actually had a bit of a run this last couple of months and is still going on. Perth's been flatter and with minimal growth, so they're at the peak of the boom. As the cycle has been flat in the east coast of Australia, it's started to pick up now, and Melbourne and Brisbane led that about 12 months ago. Canberra and Adelaide have done pretty well as well, and Sydney is now finally starting to pick up too, and the last quarter figures for Sydney are showing that the Sydney market is coming on too. So there are going to be some great opportunities, but not all properties, as I said a minute ago. Some properties are going to outperform others, and I guess they're the ones we should try and own.
Yeah, there was always pockets, isn't there? Great. Thanks for that, Michael. Okay, next one for Ed. This is from Erica in South Australia. And another trust question, Ed. This one's about the Property Investor Trust. And Erica asks, from my understanding, not many accountants know about the Property Investor Trust. I can see that it is only done by Chan and Naylor. I've read some other books about taxation, and I found that the author more or less has got the same idea as yours. However, how do we know it is legal when many accountants don't have any idea about it? What do you think? Why do you think this is so? Over to you, Ed.
Okay, thanks, Eric. I think that's a great question. The way to answer it is that we actually specialise in the area, in this area, and most accountants are generalists. They're like a GP as such. And if you take the medical profession, 20 years ago, the GP would come to your house and he'd look after everything from your heart to your legs to your head. And nowadays, it's become so specialised that, you know, if you've got a heart problem, they send you off to a cardiologist. And if you've got something wrong with your head, they send you off to a neurosurgeon and so forth. Well, in tax, it's the same. The tax laws are so complex now that it's now become very, very specialised. It's a bit like the law profession as well. So, as you know, with lawyers, some lawyers just do conveyancing, other lawyers do litigation, and some lawyers do family law matters, and they specialise in different areas. And that's where the accounting profession is going. It's becoming very, very specialised. So this is what we specialise in. This is what we're known for. We don't do other things like auditing or insolvency or anything like that. This is all we do, and we do it really well. So I guess with all the other accountants out there, they're trying to do, you know, everything, and you become a jack of all trades but a master of none. We'd prefer to be a master of this area, and hence you get this disparity. And it's a little bit frustrating for the clients, I guess, because you go along to your accountant and he doesn't know anything about trusts, let alone the Property Investors Trust, and you're trying to get them to do work for you, and they don't know anything about it, and sometimes they put it down. And generally we find that it's just because they don't know anything about it, that's why they put it down. But other than that, it's a very specialised area. That's the only way I can describe it.
Thanks for that, Ed.
Yeah. Okay.
And another quick one for you is, are Chan and Naylor planning to open a branch office in Perth soon? This is from Christian in WA.
Okay, well, funny you asked that question, but we've got Lillian Fisher over there now. So we do have a Chan and Naylor office in Western Australia now. It only opened this week, funny enough. Lillian Fisher, she's over there now. So her number there is 93888653, and she's officially opened up as Chan and Naylor.
Can I butt in,
okay,
you guys, also because I can see some questions that are coming on the internet that you can't, and somebody's interestingly asked, do you have an office in Melbourne? Lynn from Melbourne has asked that. So you haven't told the world yet. Well.
No, I guess not everyone, but Yeah, we do have an office in Melbourne. Ian Shear is a gentleman there, and you can get those details from the Chananala website, actually.
I'd also like to say that while we work together, we have no cross-affiliation or get commissions or anything from each other, but I know Ian Shear well, and Lillian also, and one of the things I like about all your guys, Tony and Ed, is that they actually are property investors themselves as well. It's interesting that they happen to use Metropole to choose their properties, and that was even before they became Chan and Ayla partners, but that's one of the great things that Ed was saying a minute ago about the specialty of your firm, that it's guys who are not just theorists, but they do it also. And I think that's important.
That's exactly right. For the other lady who asked, office in Melbourne, details on the website. Okay, now I'll give you one more, Ed, because that was a quick one. We've got Richard Simmons in Victoria who's asked, we have a property completely paid off to avoid paying tax on the rental income. What strategies would you implement?
I guess that's really not the question he should be asking. He should be asking, how do I make as much money as I can? And if I can save some tax, then that's the cream. That's the cream on top of the cake, if you like. And, creating more wealth is simply about buying more property, increasing the size of your asset. And if you do that, then not only will you make more money, which is the most important part, but at the same time, you'll save some tax because the positive gearing will get offset with the negative gearing on the new property that you're buying. And through the depreciation on the new property that you're buying, that will reduce the tax on the first property and also against your income. So let's make sure that the dog is wagging the tail, not the tail's wagging the dog. And that is to make sure you're increasing your wealth and not be focused on tax, but in focused on creating more wealth. And that, of course, is to get out and buy some more property.
Excellent. All right, Michael, back to you. We've got David from Queensland, and he's asking, as a beginner with only two investment properties, how much equity and experience would you expect before diversifying into commercial properties or even property development?
Thanks for the question, David. I think both of those are not the field for beginners. Now, I own a large proportion of my portfolio as commercial properties, and obviously has been a property developer for 20 years. A lot of people like the concept of commercial properties because they have a higher return, a higher yield. They have long leases. The tenant pays the outgoings. The tenant pays the rates and taxes. Wouldn't it be lovely to have all that plus a higher yield and long-term leases? The trouble is that they're really more cash flow plays because you don't have as much opportunity to get increases in value of the property. Commercial properties are valued very differently, and they're very yield-driven. The cycle is different, and the rules are different. I'm actually going to be discussing them at length at my upcoming real-world real estate workshop because a lot of people want to move into those. But when they become vacant, they can become vacant for many months. I'm sure you've driven past shops in your local shopping centre, maybe in the secondary positions where there's been a for-lease sign and often multiple for-lease signs for quite some time. So beginners, people who are often a little bit more dependent upon cash flow, have difficulty coping with that with commercial properties. But it's definitely the thing to consider moving into when you get to the next level. Property development, well, there's a whole range of property development, and we're going to again be discussing that at our upcoming seminar, Catch the Property Wave, where Ed and I will be speaking around Australia. So I'll give an introduction into it. I guess the simplest way of property development is renovation, and after a couple of properties, you're probably ready for that. So you can add a bit of value to your next property by doing it up a bit, or maybe even to the existing properties. But if you're talking about real, true property development, where you're buying an old house, pulling it down, putting up some duplex, some townhouses, apartments, or whatever, there's higher rewards, but there's definitely higher risks. And we really like people to have a reasonable asset base and a bit of experience behind them. And it's not actually an exact amount of money. It really depends a little bit upon your risk profile as well. And if you're aware of the risks, if you can take a minute, probably you're going to learn most of what you're going to learn in your first two or three developments, make most of your mistakes. So get a good team of people around you would be my recommendation before you move into any of those.
Yeah, that's good advice. And I'll give the next one to you again, Michael. It's from Kashin
Chung and Vic, and they've asked, do you consider the last property downturn as a major down cycle, or was that just a glitch in the continuing uptrend of property prices? Other economic experts are predicting a major correction in 2010-2011 and anticipating interest rates to climb up to 12%. What do you think about that?
Thanks for the question, Karshin. So your question really was last property downturn a downturn or just a glitch? Well, in the long-term cycle, well-located properties, capital city properties, have done about 10% per annum. And in fact, apartments have done about the same as houses as well in the long term. So I guess it was a glitch in it, as all downturns are. I saw that as the downturn in that stage of the cycle. In Sydney, it was a bigger downturn. In Melbourne, Brisbane, Canberra, Adelaide, it was probably not as big a downturn, but it was flat for 2 or 3 years, and that's because we didn't have as massive a rise in prices. So this all has to do with supply and demand. It's not because of a certain number of years. It has to do with socioeconomic factors, and because our economy is generally doing well, that's about as bad as it's going to get, in my opinion, for this cycle. And I think we've commenced the beginning of the next cycle, not the next boom. A property cycle starts after the boom with a slump phase, which we've had on the east coast of Australia. We're coming into it on the west coast and in Darwin. And we've had 3 flat years. November 2003 is when the last property cycle ended. Interest rates went up, and overnight, auction clearances dropped, sales dropped. Sydney's had a rough time, the other states not too bad a time. And I don't see a problem in 2010-2011 like you're suggesting, Karshin, because this next boom is being driven by population, by supply and demand. And with our population increasing, with minimal supply, with the immigration that's going to push up the requirement, I think we've got some good times coming well into next decade.
I agree. Ed, we'll go back to you and ask this one from Denise Newbury in New South Wales. And she's asked, how and where do I make that first jump, and should I set up a trust first, as we would be buying in joint names, and my husband's on the highest tax bracket, and me considerably lower with 2 daughters, 1 at school and 1 going to uni next year?
There's a lot of questions there, and I really need to know a lot more about your circumstances. But if I make some assumptions, perhaps your husband does not need asset protection, so he may not be in a high risk industry. Because if he is in a high risk industry, like if he's a doctor or an anaesthetist or someone who runs his own business, then there's a possibility of getting sued. If there's a possibility of getting sued, then it means that you've got to set it up in a different way. For example, we generally put it into our property investors trust. Just assuming he's not in a high risk category, then we then have to look at other things such as income tax and capital gains tax. And of course, we also need to look at what your long-term circumstances are. Is Denise going back to work later and increasing her income? Because if you set things up for the short term, then in the long term, when your circumstances changes, then it's going to affect your tax. Now, just assuming that Denise won't go back to work and she's going to continue to just do part-time work, then you've got to look at land tax. So if it's in Queensland, there's different land tax rules to New South Wales, and New South Wales has different land tax rules to Victoria. So now, just assuming that it's in New South Wales, for a minute, I think Denise is from New South Wales, if she's purchased the property in New South Wales. Yep. Then if there's no asset protection issues, then there's no reason why you can't buy the property in the husband's name alone, because he's the highest income earner and he can then get the maximum tax refund against his name. Now, the problem with putting it in joint names is that you won't get as much of a refund in Denise's side, and you can get a lot more by having it in the husband's name. The problem with having the husband's name is that later on when the property becomes positively geared, then the positive gearing is taxed in the husband's name. And, of course, if you ever sold that property, then the capital gains tax is taxed at his marginal tax rate instead of Denise's. So it's not an easy question to answer without all the facts, because generally in our financial health check, we sit down and we go through all these things with the client. And but in our upcoming seminars, I'll be covering a lot more of that in a lot more detail. So I'm sorry I couldn't answer your question. It just depends on your circumstances, and I need to ask you, about 10 questions and getting the right answers from you before I can create the right structure for Denise. But that's why it is complicated. It's not just biting joint names, because if you did that, then somewhere down the track it could hurt you, because your circumstances might change.
Cool. Well, thanks for that, Ed. We'll ask a couple more questions of you, Michael, and then we'll have a little bit of a mid-break. So this one's from Robert in Victoria. And Robert's asking, in your experience, is it better to invest in a townhouse or a house? And also Eric in Victoria has asked, is it worth purchasing units or apartments in the suburbs for capital growth, as I'm seeing houses are taking off but too expensive for me to buy at the moment? So a couple of different viewpoints there. What's your answer to that, Michael?
Thanks for the question, guys. I think the question sort of boils down to, should I buy something with a land component, the house, or should I buy something with maybe a lesser land component but in a better area like a townhouse or an apartment? And in fact, I've just gone through my first book, How to Grow a Multi-Million Dollar Property Portfolio in Your Spare Time, and rewritten it. And one of the sections I've rewritten, and I guess I've changed my mind on in the last couple of years, is that old concept that houses go down in value and land appreciates, because maybe from a tax point of view they do, and you can depreciate the building, but really the question is, do you want to own a house on some land 50 kilometres out of town, or would you rather own an apartment with minimal land and just a portion of land under the block 5 kilometres from one of our 2 kilometres from our main CBD? Interestingly, the concept that townhouses and apartments don't go up in value as much has also been quashed over the years, and the latest figures from ResiDex that came out just recently, and I was only looking at tonight preparing for our upcoming seminars, showed that in some capital cities, on average, median increases in apartments were higher than houses over a 10 and 20 year period, which really means that you'll get just as good long-term capital growth and maybe even a little bit better rental performance from well-located apartments. The thing is nowadays that they're hard to build, they're more expensive to build, town planning is harder. So I guess the question is, what are you going to do? What are your long-term plans? If you want to maybe do some development, as somebody else asked about a while ago, then sure, you'd maybe buy a house which has got some land component with some development potential. If you want to do a refurbishment, maybe buying an older apartment close to town would work well. Often what dictates what you purchase is how much money you can afford. But the other thing is, who are the tenants going to be? And the way we're starting to live, the way we're going to live in the future, the next generations are going to want smaller accommodation without the big backyards. They're not going to be playing cricket in the big backyards. The majority of people are wanting medium density accommodations now become the preferred style of living. So I think there's some great opportunities in townhouses and apartments. You don't need to have the land underneath.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So that's a great answer for Robert and Eric. So what we'll do now, folks, we're almost halfway through these questions. We actually still have quite a few questions to cover. But what we'll do for those of you at home, if you've been sitting and attending, listening to all of this, you might want to stand up and have a bit of a stretch. And while we take this break, we'll remind you of the upcoming seminars and dates. So you'll be able to see Michael and Ed live in Melbourne this Saturday on the 28th of July, and all of these events start at 9 o'clock and go through till 4:30. Brisbane also is the following day, which is Sunday the 29th of July, this Sunday. Next weekend, the boys are in Sydney on the 11th of August, which is the Saturday, and Canberra on the 12th of August, the following day, and then they shoot over to Perth on the 18th of August, which is a Saturday. So in the next 4 weeks. If, for those of you around the country, that's your opportunity to actually go along and see. And for those of you listening on the website, you should see a nice big Get Seminar Details button in front of you. You can click on that and book in if you haven't already. And I think, Michael, you seem to have a few more questions on property, so we'll probably come back to you and ask the next ones. Did you have anything you wanted to add before we continue?
No, thank you.
Okay, so this one's from Jenny in Perth. And Jenny says, I have approximately $350,000 in equity. I think I've counted that right. Yes, $350,000 equity is in an investment property. My question is, in general, can I borrow more if I sold the property and use the cash deposits to buy my property, or can I borrow as much using the equity and holding the property?
That's a common request people ask. In other words, well, I've actually made some money, my property's gone up in value, or I've paid off my home, should I now sell it and use the money elsewhere? And I think all of us, Tony, Ed and myself, have got a very similar opinion on that, that you actually don't make money by selling property. Other investments you can, and sometimes you have to sell, but you don't need to sell property to take the money out. You borrow against it, because when you do sell, unless it's your principal place of residence, you're going to actually have to pay tax on that, capital gains tax, and then you're going to, when you purchase a new property, have to pay stamp duty, agent's commission on selling your old property, legal fees and finance fees backwards and forwards as well. And I don't know, I think Ed's got the figure that you probably end up losing about 5% of the value of your property just to sort of get back into the market again.
So it's about 20%, Michael.
About 20%, is it, Ed?
20%,
it's a lot then, isn't
yes.
It?
Yes.
So you'd agree with me that don't sell the property, borrow against it and move on.
That's right.
Maybe
so
right,
if absolutely, because if you take 20% of the value of her property, that's approximately how much she would lose by moving the property. So that money that she would...
Some notional capital gains tax in there as well. Would that bring it up to the 20%?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. If you add the stamp duty and the capital gains tax and agents' commissions and all that, it's approximately 20%. So if it's a $600,000 property, then 20% is $120,000. And instead of giving $120,000 like that in a lump sum away to the government, why don't you use just a bit of it each, like 10,000 of it to each year to fund the negative gearing? And if you use 10,000 a year, that would last you 12 years. And in 12 years' time, that property would have doubled in value.
Thank you. I think we're all along the same wavelength there.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Another one for you, Michael. In today's world, there are many people who are asset rich and income poor. What opportunities are there for these people, especially those who have retired, to obtain finance to invest in property? That's from Janet in Queensland.
Well, Janet, thanks for the question. It's fascinating because today I had somebody in my office. I very rarely see clients anymore, because I've got other team members who do that. But I had somebody who was a business associate and sat down, and he told me exactly the same story. He had a house in the suburb of Richmond of Victoria, which is worth $1 million. He's got about a $100,000 loan, and he's got two investment properties. But he hasn't got much income because he's gone out on his own in business 2 years ago. His wife's gone back to study, and they've got three kids. And so they're asset rich, but actually cash flow poor. And he said, but I know what you're doing, Michael, and I hear what you're doing, and I hear what your clients are doing. I've actually got to get into property now. I can see the property values going up, but how am I going to service this? What am I going to do? And I explained to him a concept that we'll be discussing in detail at our seminar, but it's also in my book, How to Grow a Multi-Million Dollar Property Portfolio, and it's in Ed and Tony's new book also, How to Achieve Wealth for Life. And it's the concept of using some of the equity in your property, and Ed just even touched on it a minute ago for Jenny from Perth, the concept of using some of your asset to use as a deposit for your next property, and then having a line of credit to pay for the negative gearing for a couple of years. Now, that's a difficult concept, and it's a foreign concept for most of us because you're taught not to borrow to pay debt. If you can't afford it, don't pay for it. But I'd just say that you don't borrow to buy depreciating assets, but it's hard to explain over the phone. It's well explained graphically in the two books I've mentioned, and you can get them at the Knowledge Centre website or at our Property Update website or at all the good bookshops, of course. And we'll show it in a nice graphic form at our seminars that you aren't stuck like you think you are. You've got huge opportunities, Janet. The fact that you've actually got equity in your property is great. You now can use that, and a good finance broker will show you how you can use it as not only seed capital for your investment, but as a buffer to cover your negative gearing for a couple of years.
That's absolutely correct. So for those of you who might have joined us halfway through or a little bit late, this is being recorded, and you'll be able to download and listen to it all over again on the website. Ed, I'm going to ask you the next question. This is from Adam Regan in Newcastle. And he said, can I fully protect myself from being sued by having insurance instead of trusts?
Okay, that's a good question, Adam. You can insure yourself for various different things. And I've been around long enough to know that the insurance companies are quite happy to take your premium, but as soon as you put a claim in, they generally fight tooth and nail to not pay the claim, and they'll find any little way to get out of it. And we had an example recently where a client up in, I think it was up in Darwin, the tenant had actually damaged the property quite extensively. There was about $60,000 worth of damage. And when he claimed on his insurance, the insurance company refused to pay because they argued that it was willful and not malicious damage. Now, I don't know what the difference is between willful and malicious damage, but to me, damage is damage. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, you can take out insurance, but the insurance company generally, that's not, will try and find a way to get around paying you, paying it, and you find yourself in the courts fighting them. So yes, that's the first line of defence, but you need the second and the third and the fourth line of defence in these kind of things.
I find this an interesting discussion, guys, because I've heard a number of people get up on stage and say you don't need a trust, just insure yourself. What's the hassle of having a trust? Why wouldn't people have a trust? Why would people want to insure themselves, which is an annual cost anyway and has certain risks? It's not a sensible question even to me.
Yes.
Adam, I'm not being rude to you and your question. I just know that certain people actually are proponents of this theory, and that's what I guess I was suggesting is not. I can't see the reason behind it.
Yes, I'll totally agree with
you. Yeah, you either put your faith in insurance companies or, put simply, like Ed's saying, if you don't own the asset, then they can't take it off you anyway. So it's just another layer of protection. There's another one here for you, Ed, which is, what is the main advantage of setting up a family trust? Helena, Victoria.
Okay, now I better just provide a little bit of an explanation before I answer that. Just to make sure that Helena is asking the right question, because a family trust is a discretionary trust, and people use the term family trust quite loosely, and the word trust or family trust is simply the word trust is simply a generic term, and it's a bit like saying motor vehicle. There's all sorts of different types of motor vehicle, just as there is all sorts of different types of trusts. If Helena is specifically asking about a family trust, then the answer is the advantages of setting up a family trust is that for asset protection, so you can keep your assets, your properties in the family trust, so that if anybody tried to sue you, then they can't get hold of the property. But generally, we don't use family trusts for property. And the reason why we don't use family trusts for property is because the negative gearing gets quarantined inside the family trust, and you can't offset the negative gearing against your wages. So it's a terrible vehicle to use for property as such. And what we prefer is our property investors trust, which allows which gives you asset protection, but it also allows you to get the negative gearing out of the trust and against your own tax in your own name, so you can claim the refund back from the tax man. I'm not sure whether Helena has got confused with the trust, but if she's specifically asking about a family trust, then then we don't see many advantages with a family trust. We generally try to stay away from them.
Okay, thanks, Ed. And back to you, Michael. There's one here from Malcolm Henderson in Sydney. And Malcolm asks, what are the best methods to use to find the up-and-coming hotspots with so much going on around Australia, mining towns, sea towns, etc.? I'm looking for opportunities to turn into positive cash flow.
Thanks for the question, Malcolm. I guess there's two elements there, hotspots and positive cash flow. Let me answer the second one first. I understand why a lot of people want positive cash flow or think they need positive cash flow. And that's often when you start with your investments. If you're buying well-located properties, unfortunately, you don't have, the rent doesn't usually cover the interest. The theory that we, Tony, Ed, myself, and most people who have become wealthy in property suggest is that you don't buy positive cash flow properties. You tend to buy high growth properties, and almost by definition, you don't end up getting positive cash flow with those. In fact, you have negative cash flow, Malcolm. Now, I understand why it's harder, but it's really hard with positive cash flow properties to grow a portfolio, because it's really hard to get the second deposit and the third deposit. But with high growth properties, as they increase in value, what happens is you can borrow against the increase in value and buy again. In the last week alone, I've had two emails from clients, one actually today from a Jason from Sydney, and another one from Charles in Melbourne, who bought properties and said, dear, they just had them revalued. Actually, I can think of a third one this week also, who's had his property revalued that they only bought at the end of last year, because we've actually had some suburbs really, really outperform in Melbourne in the last little while. And because there have been 6 or 9 months now since they've purchased, they've been able to revalue, not put their hand in their pockets for any more deposit, borrow against the increasing value. So we strongly believe the way to develop a significant portfolio is to own high growth properties. So no argument about looking for good areas that are going to grow, and you're sort of talking about that with hotspots, I understand, but do it for growth, because residential real estate is by nature a high growth, low yield investment. If you're looking for yield, my suggestion, Malcolm, is buy managed funds or property trusts or other things, because good properties don't give you good yield. Okay, but then how do you find hotspots? How do you find the next hotspot? Well, my question then to you would be, Malcolm, are you a speculator or are you an investor? If you, by definition, are looking for a hotspot, it'll do well, maybe, but maybe it won't be, because who knows? I would rather do it a different way. If you find a property area, an area that's always done well in the long term and outperformed, a minute ago I said that average properties went up 10% per annum, which means some would have gone up 15 and 20% and others would have gone up 5 or 6% to average out of that. I'd first of all look at the cycle in each state, the state you're in or where you want to invest, and see where is it. Is it the right time to get in? Then look for areas that in the long term have always outperformed rather than the next hotspot. I wouldn't look for the next fad. That's a bit of get-rich-quick scheme and may work, but by definition, a bit of speculation, it may not work as well. And then within those areas that have always performed well and outperformed, and they're not hard to do. You get reports from Residex or RP Data or the Real Estate Institute or at the back of Australian Property Investor magazine, find a suburb that has always done well. And unless there's any major change going to happen to it, it's likely to continue to do well. And then within those suburbs, find the right sort of property that will outperform, because some will always be slightly better investments than others. And by doing that, you will outperform the market without looking at the speculation. Look, I know people talk about sea change, about the next mining boom, about infrastructure, and you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I don't want to speculate or risk with my money. We definitely don't with our clients. So hotspots are a hot topic, but I wouldn't be looking for them.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Michael. Ed, the next one's for you. This is from Rick Ashwood in Victoria. And he's got a very interesting question. It says, given that hybrid discretionary trusts have yet to be legally tested in the courts, what factors make you confident that when such a challenge is tested, the trusts will get through? Interesting question from Rick in Victoria.
Well, thanks, Rick. Thanks for that question. Actually, I'm not sure whether that's quite correct, because if you go to tax ruling IT2684, it says it's quite okay, and that's a tax ruling. That's from the tax department themselves. And if you want to go into their website, you can actually look at that ruling, and they'll even go further. They'll even show you how to do it properly with a hybrid discretionary trust. So I'm not sure where your question sort of originated from, but or where your thinking was for that, but it's definitely okay. The other thing I wanted to say is that it's probably not the right question to ask. It's not the trust that's the problem generally. It's how the trust is used that's the problem. And the best example that I can use is back in the 80s, they did these things called bottom of the harbour schemes, and it involved a company, and they impregnated a company with assets, and then they stripped the company of these assets, and the company ended up at the bottom of the harbour, hence bottom of the harbour schemes. But it wasn't the company that was a problem, because companies are still being used today. It was what they did with the company that was a problem. And another example was in the late 90s, they had these things called employee benefits trusts. And again, the tax department attacked the employee benefits trust, which is a trust. And again, it wasn't the trust that was a problem. It was how the trust was used that was the problem. So the trust is still around today. And I guess another analogy is that you can buy a car and you can drive it legally, or you can drive it illegally. So it's not the car that's the problem, it's the way you drive it. So there's nothing wrong with hybrid discretionary trust per se. It's just how you use it that's the problem. So I hope that's answered your question, Rick.
That's right. Thank you, Ed. And Michael, we'll come back to you. This is a question from Chris Young in Carlton. That's a very good question. Actually, how should a person who is interested in property investment get started? There are numerous seminars, books, gurus out there. How do I choose who to listen to?
Thanks for the question, Chris. Yes, how do you choose who to listen to? Because there are lots of different theories and there's lots of different ways. Look, Ed and I are both in a book that's called Secrets of Property Millionaires Exposed, and there's different people doing it in different ways, some with wraps and some with cash flow positive properties and some with the high growth properties and some with property development, like we said. I guess it's how you'd choose a coach to do anything else. I'd be listening carefully to somebody who's done it, not just a theorist, and somebody who's done it for a period of time, because during a property boom, people can look good. One of the easiest things to do is be successful during a boom. And so a lot of people have written books and were in the last boom giving seminars telling you how to become very, very wealthy. But they've actually never traded through the ups and downs. Look, Chris, if you were given a letter by your solicitor saying your long-lost cousin had died and left you some money, but the only way you could get it was to climb to the top of the highest mountain to get the key that was there. I know it's a bit fanciful. Who would you choose as a coach? Would you choose somebody who had only read it in books, or would you choose the natives who'd actually climbed that mountain three or four times and got up and down there twice? And how much of your inheritance would you share with them? And it's much the same here. Don't be scared to leverage the knowledge of people who have already done it before and achieved what you've wanted to achieve and gotten where you've wanted to get to. Now, I know it's a little bit hard, so you've got to actually wallow through all the information that's on the internet and in the books and listen, but the question is, how do you choose the right guru? Well, see what they've done, see how long they've done it, and see what their track record is. How do you get started? Well, you've already started by coming along and listening to us, which is fantastic. Thank you for doing that and giving up your time. I think you should go to the books that are on the Knowledge Center website, a property update website. There's hundreds of property books out there. And we've selected a small group of them because we've actually read them all and seen which are the ones that we think are most useful for beginners like you and for more experienced investors. Come along to our seminars. Listen to these free webcasts that we're having. Don't be scared to pay for your education because it's going to fast track it, but pay the right people.
I agree. Excellent. And the next one, Ed, we'll probably get a couple more questions out of both of you guys before we have to wrap up. Enzo from New South Wales has said, as a currently single man, is it possible to protect my investment portfolio against a future relationship split?
Okay, thanks, Enzo, for that question. Well, it depends on where you have the assets. If you already own the assets, then the only way to protect it is through what's called a prenuptial agreement. Now, a couple of years ago, prenuptial agreements were not recognised in Australia. They were recognised overseas, but they were not recognised in Australia. But that's been changed. So you'd enter into a prenuptial agreement with your future partner, and you identified the assets that each party brings to the table, and that's pretty much the only way that you can do it.
Yeah, that's right. Or not actually get into a relationship is probably the other way.
Yes.
If I'm not mistaken, once you get in a relationship, even if the properties are held in a trust, or family trust, a property investors trust, the family court will peel that away, and still they can be shared amongst the parties when they split. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct, Michael. Yes.
Trust
generally protect you from creditors or outsiders, but they don't protect you from your spouse. From the family law court tends to be able to get around companies and trusts to split the family up for the family members. So if you're bringing assets into a marriage that was assets from outside of your marriage, then the only way to protect is through a prenuptial agreement.
Okay, Ed, we'll do one more quick one for you. Is it worth... here we go. I'll ask this one here from Nicholas in Victoria. Is it worthwhile buying my first property in a trust? In doing so, I'll miss out on the first home buyer's grant. And also, Nicholas from Victoria again, I think, is how to structure the beginning of my property portfolio. So another structuring question.
Okay, that's a good question. I've sat down and sort of worked the numbers out. I don't think putting it into a trust is the right thing to do if you want the first home owner's grant. And the reason for that is that by putting it into a trust, you'll miss out on the first home owner's grant, and it can be up to $30,000. So you've got the stamp duty exemption, and you've got the $14,000 grant from the government. And yet, when you add that all up together, it can be as much as $30,000. So to give away $30,000 and by putting into a trust isn't worth it. So my advice to people who can qualify for the first homeowner's grant is to not put it into a trust, buy the property in your own name, and then get the money from the government, and then all the other benefits that the trust brings, we can build that into the next property. And there are different ways of fixing things up. So it's you know, when the time comes, it's just to pop into our office and we can work things out for you. So it's too much money to give away. That's the first question. And then also, how to structure the beginning of my property portfolio. Well, the first one obviously is to get the first homeowner's grant, and that's got to be in your own name to qualify. And then the second one, it just depends on where you're buying, what state that it's in, and whether it's going to be rented out or you're going to move into it, move out of the first one and move into the second one. So we'd need to sit down and work through the details.
Thanks, Ed. And Michael, we'll have a couple more for you, I think, before we finish up. Bruce from South Australia has asked, how do you fund the shortfall between interest repayments and rent?
Great. Well, I think we almost covered that in the last one of the previous questions also, that there's a number of ways of covering it. If you can afford to pay it, you can pay it. Otherwise, usually what we recommend is to structure your loan so that an element of it goes to your deposit, and an element of it is a buffer. You shouldn't ever use your last cent, so you should have a bit of a buffer for repairs that happen, for things that go wrong, for unforeseen things. And some people need a buffer for their interest shortfall each month. So we sometimes suggest a line of credit, which means it's like a big credit card. You don't pay interest on it until you borrow against it, and then you're using the line of credit to each month as there's an interest rate shortfall, a negative shortfall from the rent over the mortgage payments. You take some of the money out, and over time, the rent creeps up, and so you don't have to subsidize it as much. And with time, the value of the property goes up, and you can just refinance and start the whole thing over again.
That's right. Frank in New South Wales has asked about Sydney. Do you still see Sydney growing at an average of 7 to 10% over the next 10 years? It seems hard to see given the already high prices and record low affordability. Another affordability type question.
Well, Sydney has actually had the biggest slump of all the states in the last 3 years, and the latest figures are suggesting that Sydney is starting to pick up. And when Ed and I are there in a couple of weekends' time, I'll be going through the figures and why I think there's going to be some good opportunities in Sydney. Sydney is still going to be Australia's largest capital city. It's still going to be getting a lot of people coming in from overseas, and most of those are going to want to live in the CBD or near CBD suburbs, not in the regional areas. And while affordability is going to be an issue for some people, if you look at what's happened to other states, other countries and overseas which have become more mature, sure, there's going to be a smaller percentage of owner-occupiers, which is great for most of us on this call because we're all investors, so we don't mind that some people won't ever be able to afford their houses. We're going to be there to provide them with the right sort of rental accommodation. Sydney has done just under 10% per annum over the last 10 years. I think it was about 9 point something. Because of the stage of the cycle we're at, we've had 3 flat years. If you took it at a different 10-year period, you'd actually get much better returns. There's no reason to suggest with shortage of supply, with no rental properties, with people still forming families, with the baby boomers going to change the way they're going to want to live, with more single people, so for every family as people start divorcing, there's going to be 2 households, with more older people living, with young families still being formed, there's no reason at all why the cycle won't continue on.
I agree. And we've got a couple of quick questions in regards to where to buy. So May from Victoria has asked, first-time investor in Melbourne with a price range of around 250K, where would you suggest?
250K, well, that actually starts making things difficult. And I guess one of the questions is, do you go to one of the further outer suburbs to buy something with some land, or do you buy something in closer? I believe for that sort of level, you're going to be able to buy yourself a one-bedroom apartment in a middle-ring suburb. And I would prefer that than a older property on a small block of land that's all you could afford further out. There's still room for one-bedroom apartments. I think, well, in fact, Pam and I have just bought a whole block of 14 one-bedroom apartments because there's lots of single people, there's young single people, there's a whole new generation of what Bernard Salt called mingles, middle-aged singles, people who have divorced or separated or chosen to live on their own. And so one-bedroom apartments aren't for all of those people. Many want two bedrooms because they want their computer room or their study. But I have no issue with suggesting in the inner southeastern or even in the northeastern suburbs to buy at that price bracket. You could get an apartment that will give you very good long-term capital growth and very fair return.
Excellent. And we've got a couple here. One from Wayne Walker.
1 minute, Tony.
1 minute? Okay. We'll finish off with this one. Is it better to invest in Melbourne or Brisbane?
They're both at an interesting stage of the property cycle, Wayne, where they've both started to move forward. And I think there's opportunities in both those areas. People in Brisbane live slightly differently to people in Melbourne. So if you're going to invest in Brisbane, while more people are living in apartments than used to, the sort of property that performs well in Brisbane actually tends to be a house and land in one of the inner suburbs. In Melbourne, we're finding medium-density apartments are performing well. To be honest, I'm personally investing in both. Pam and I have invested in Melbourne strongly, and I've actually just given George, our partner in Brisbane, the mandate to buy me a block of apartments in Brisbane, so I'm putting my money in both.
Agreed. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for that. We'll wrap up now, and for those listening, thank you for listening. Thank you for taking the time. This event was sponsored by Metropole Properties and Channa Naylor. And you can actually listen to it for free again on the website, if you want to get a recap. And for those of you who said questions we did not ask, and all of you listening, you can obviously attend our seminar. You click the Get Seminar Details and you can see Ed and Michael live over the next few weeks. And thank you all, and we'll do this again in the future.
Thanks, Tony.
It has just stopped recording. Thank you.